This morning I want to continue going through, mostly in logical order, topics of money management. In the beginning we've talked about laboring and saving and investing, and then we talked about debt and things like that, and then being rich and being poor. And now I want to talk about retirement, since I'm getting down toward the end of this series. And I did touch on retirement earlier in the series when I talked about saving for retirement. And back then I was basically discussing how to do retirement right. That is, how to stay out of debt, save money, invest 15% of your gross income for your entire life, and then you can live off the income of your investments that they produce in your latter years when you can't work anymore. That's basically making money work for you instead of working for money. Most people in this world work for money. The few that have figured it out make money work for them. So that's really the goal to get to in your life, if you can. But what I want to talk about mainly today is actually another version of retirement, the modern American version of retirement, which is not the way to go about things. Today, retirement, the term, basically means hitting a magical age in your 50s or 60s, some random age, stopping working, collecting a check from the government, and then spending the next decade or so of your life in leisure. That's essentially what people mean by retirement today. And that concept is not found in the Bible anywhere. You can kind of search it through cover to cover. You're not going to find that idea in the Bible. Now, I'm not opposed to all retirement. Not at all. There are a couple of versions of retirement that I'll talk about later in this series. First, what I call natural retirement, and there's certainly nothing wrong with that. That's just what happens. That's totally normal and natural. And then there's another thing I would call earned retirement, and there's nothing wrong with that either. But these are totally different things than this American idea of retirement. So what I would call modern American retirement is what the Bible would call sleeping in harvest. This is pretty much describes it here in Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 5. Proverbs 10:5. And I talked about some of this earlier in this study. I talked about it in the Proverbs series. So this is probably, most of this is not going to be anything new, but it's very necessary to be said because of the situation this country finds itself in, with millions of people in this very circumstance, and it's not going to turn out well for a lot of people, I don't think. Proverbs 10 and verse 5 says, "He that gathereth in summer is a wise son, but he that sleepeth in harvest is a son that causeth shame." Now, of course, there's the natural, obvious interpretation of this verse, that if you planted your fields and just decided in September, you know, I just feel like taking a big long month-long nap and just taking it easy and then just letting everything just, you know, go to seed and rot, that would be a shameful thing, right? Or if you planted a garden in August, September comes along and you just decide, you know, I'm just tired, it's time to kick back and just let all the food just lay there and rot, let the animals eat it or whatever. That would be a shameful thing, obviously. So, I mean, there's the natural explanation of the verse. But then there's also a figurative application, I think, which really fits into what I'm talking about here. In a figurative sense, harvest is the season of life in which the effort of a lifetime of labor and diligence produces maximum income. Right, so if you think about it as a season of life, springtime, you're young, summertime, you start off in your profession, and you gain wisdom and experience, and you start to be more and more productive. And then come harvest time, that's when you reap all the benefits that you've worked a lifetime to achieve, and now you're making maximum income, and you can really clean up. That would be, you know, the harvest season of life. It's the period of time right before the winter of life when you can no longer work anymore, right? Winter in life comes, and what do you do in wintertime? What do we do in winter? What do most people do in wintertime? You sit in the house. It's too cold. You can't do anything. You just sit in there. You look out the windows. at the outside world and you're just observing it, basically. That's what happens in the wintertime of life. You sit there and you watch the world go by. You pretty much can't do anything but sit in your chair, twiddle your thumbs. You know, that's what happens in the wintertime. Harvest is the time before that. It's a time in a man's career when he is at his peak and he's earning the most money of his life. Usually, that's what usually happens at that time in life. This is the time in life when the most money can be earned and saved for the coming winter of life, especially if a man has not saved up enough to this point. Now, what you should have been doing is saving during the springtime when you were young, during the summertime when you were building your career, and, you know, and then into the harvest and getting interest on your side and you know, building all that up. But if you didn't do that, if you dropped the ball, didn't know, whatever, then the harvest time of life is like, this is the time to get busy. You know, I'm not making minimum wage like I was when I was 18. I'm making some serious bank right now, and I can lay up a ton of money in these last few years. That's the time to really get busy if you haven't done so, you know, prior to that point in your life. Now, just as a son who sleeps during the literal harvest causes shame, so does the Son of God, and I'm speaking of us as sons of God, so does the Son of God who figuratively sleeps during the harvest time of life. There, when you're at maximum earning potential, and then because society tells you, oh, you've hit a magical age, stop working, you know, and go enjoy yourself. That's going to cause some shame if you haven't done it right up until that point. So I would say make hay while the sun shines. While you still can, work. Because Jesus taught it's important to work while it's day before the night comes when no man can work. John 9 and verse 4. John 9 and verse 4. Like I said, nothing new here. I've been harping on this for 10 years. But it's more important now than it's ever been because we're getting closer and closer and closer to the time when the crap hits the fan. John 9 and verse 4. Jesus said, I must work the works of him that sent me while it is day. The night cometh when no man can work. Again, see, this lends credibility to my figurative interpretation of Proverbs 10, right? Jesus isn't literally talking about, I've got 4 hours left today to work and the night's coming, I can't work tonight. He's talking about a season in life. Work while it's day, because there's a time coming in life when you can't work anymore. Right? So that just validates my interpretation there of the Proverbs verse about sleeping and harvest. And that just came to me. I didn't even think about it until right now. Now, millions of Americans have been sleeping during harvest for the last generation or two. The American dream for many has been to retire as soon as possible and spend the rest of their life playing and enjoying leisure. That's what the average American thinks of, that what they long for. They can't wait to just get to that magical age, stop working, and then just play and have fun or whatever. And you know what? That's okay if you can do it on your own dime. If you spent a lifetime of working, under-consuming, saving, being diligent, being disciplined, if that's what you want to do, go ahead. I'll talk about that later. But you know, Florida is full of people like this. You go down to Florida and you see lots of people, lots of old retired people that are just enjoying themselves, doing nothing, basically just spending their lives, just kicking back, enjoying themselves. You know, which again, if that's your thing, I guess, and if you can do it on your own dime, that's okay. Wouldn't be for me, but many of these people, I'm not talking about the Florida people, I'm just talking about many of the American people. Many of these people that are, you know, currently retired, so-called, were able to get away with living beyond their means and saving very little for their entire lives because they trusted that pensions and the Social Security system were going to provide for them in their old age. Pensions are pretty much the way of the dinosaur, with the exception of government pensions, and those, a lot of them are in really bad shape. A lot of state government pensions are in bad shape, and probably that's going to be a bruised reed to lean on in the future. But that's what, you know, that's what people used to do. People used to just work for a company for 35 years, retire, the company give them a pension, until companies realize, wow, we're going to go broke doing this, and they don't do it anymore, and they say, you know what, you're a big boy, save your own money, reinvest, you know, provide for your own retirement. And I think people are still in that mindset, oh, I work for 35 years, I stop working, and I get a check. That's the way it used to work for a lot of people. It doesn't work that anymore, work that way anymore. If you want to stop working after 35 years, you better spend 35 years laying up money in your own investment account and, you know, being funding your own retirement. You know, these the days of somebody else taking care of you are going to soon be over. Most pension plans and the socialist insecurity system itself are insolvent. Just go look it up. Go look up all these pension plans. I already gave you the figures for the Social Security system here several weeks ago in this study. By the government's own calculation, Social Security will run out of money in 2033. The trust funds will. And the trust funds provide a big chunk of the benefits. The trust funds will be empty in 2033, in 8 years from now. And automatic cuts will have to be made. Unless they do something first to shore it up. And maybe they will, I don't know. Congress doesn't do anything these days. Nothing good anyway. But even if they did, you can't just conjure up money out of nowhere. So either they're going to raise the age where you can start collecting, so people have to work longer, which is fine, or they'll have to raise the contribution percentage, raise your FICA taxes, which means screwing the rest of us so a bunch of other old people can collect, or they'll have to raise the limit that on the income limit on which Social Security gets capped, screwing other people. Right now it gets capped at 170 some thousand. After that point, you don't pay Social Security tax anymore. Well, they'll just raise that way up, so now they're going to be taking people that are actually productive, small business owners that make a decent income, and they'll be whacking them at 13.5% extra of their income after they're already taking 30-some percent of it, which will just further exacerbate the mess that we're in. So whatever the solution will be, it's not going to be good. But if they don't do anything, automatic like 20-some percent cut in 2033. So if you're under 60 years old, I suggest that you don't even figure Social Security into your retirement plan. I think if you're any age, don't factor it in. But especially if you're under 60, forget about it. Don't even think about it. When I think about planning for my future to have enough laid up, I don't like to use the word retire, but when I think about planning for the future to have enough laid up for my wife and I to live for the rest of our lives, Social Security doesn't even enter my mind. I never think about it. It doesn't even exist. Whether or not I'll collect anything or not, I don't even think about it. I don't think about that. I don't think about any inheritance that I may or may not get. I don't think about any of that stuff. I think about whatever I can lay up and save myself, and I think about nothing else. There's no white knight in shining armor coming to save me. I need to take care of myself with the help of God. And that should be everybody's attitude. You are on your own. Plan accordingly. Now, if Social Security checks continue to be sent in the future, and they probably will, I mean, they'll send a check out, or, you know, your direct deposit or whatever. They're not going to stop doing that, of course, because, you know, they'd have some kind of a revolution of octogenarians, you know, shaking their canes at them in Washington or whatever. they'll still send the checks. They're just not going to buy much, that's all. They're just going to, in the future, they'll just buy less and less because they won't keep up with inflation. And I'll give you an example of this. And I, like I said, I've been warning about this repeatedly for years, for 10 years. This is, you know, nothing new. But in 2021, you remember 2021, happened right after 2020. In 2020, the government printed up trillions and trillions of dollars for the whole COVID scam and just handed it out like candy to everybody. And everybody stopped, or a lot of people stopped working, and then you handed out a bunch of money to people, and what do you got? You got more money, less goods. What happens, right? And prices go up. It's called inflation. Well, in 2021, the effects of all the government spending and the money printing that facilitates it finally began to show up in significantly higher consumer prices. And those prices have not come down, and they're not going to, right? We had crazy inflation back in 2021, and in 2022, the inflation rate has come down some, but in order for prices to go back to where they were, inflation would have to go negative a long ways. Well, yeah, good luck with that. inflation's, I don't know if it's ever gone negative since the Fed was created in 1913. But anyway, so prices went up. According to the Consumer Price Index, the CPI, which is how the government measures inflation, prices went up 7% in 2021, which means that according to the government, prices went up 7%, right? CPI goes up, they're saying prices went up 7%. The thing is, I've talked about this before, the government changed the way that they calculate the CPI in the 1980s because we had a lot of inflation in the 1970s. And so the government changed the way that they calculate it to understate inflation. They wanted people to think that the inflation rate is low. Don't believe those lion eyes of yours when you're at the grocery store. Trust us, inflation's only 3%, right? That's what they've been doing for a long time. Well, what this allows them to do is give a smaller cost of living increase to Social Security recipients because it's based on the CPI. So, for instance, in 2021, inflation, the real inflation rate was about 15% or more. You can look at John Williams' shadow stats. He calculates inflation based on the old way that they used to do it, which is just looking at the price increases of stuff, normal stuff that everybody buys, right? Just look at that. And it's about double what they say it is. And so what happens is to Social Security recipients is their payments increase at a slower rate than prices are rising, right? Prices are rising at 15% per year, but because the CPI is 7%, Social Security recipients, their checks increase by 7% when actual cost of living is increasing by 15%. So in real terms, Social Security recipients, their checks are decreasing every year. That means that Social Security recipients actually got a cut in their benefits by 8% in real terms in 2021. Prices were actually up 15%. The government said it was 7%. The government gives them a 7% pay raise, whatever you want to call it, except there was an 8% cost of living, 8% price increase on top of that. So their checks actually went down 8% in real purchasing power terms. That's very likely, very unlikely, that is, that inflation is going to come back down to pre-2020 levels. Now, prices are, forget about it, prices are never going to come, I don't think, are ever going to come down. But it's unlikely that the inflation rate is ever going to come down below 2020 levels. Very, very unlikely, I think. And the reason for that is, there's many reasons for that, but one of the big reasons is that the government is now spending over $1 trillion a year paying on the debt, on the national debt. And they're paying on it on an average, I think, of 4%. The bonds that they've issued are about 4%. Those bonds are all going to mature and come due, or a lot of them, about 75% of them, I think, if I remember right, are going to come due in the next few years. They're going to have to reinvest all those bonds. And right now, interest rates are way higher. Well, the Fed is going to bring interest rates down again, and that's probably in large part why, because the government will go insolvent and bankrupt. It literally won't be able to it won't be able to pay out for the necessary things, Social Security, Medicare, military. I mean, that's what they think are necessary anyway. They're not going to be able to pay all that stuff because it's all going to be consumed with interest payments. So they got to get interest payments down. Well, how do you do that? The Fed lowers interest rates. And what happens when the Fed lowers interest rates? Inflation goes up. When interest rates go down, inflation goes up, right? More people borrow money, more money in the system. And then to force interest rates down, not to get all economical on you here, but the Fed can declare that interest rates are going to be whatever they want, but the market will declare they're going to be higher than that. The market's going to say, you know what, I'm not going to lend money to the U.S. government at 2% interest when real inflation's 10%. I'm not going to lose 8% loaning money to the government. I want a higher rate of return. If inflation's 10%, I want at least 12% on the money I'm loaning to the government when I buy the bonds. And if I don't get that, I'm not going to buy them. Well, if the market wants 12% and the Fed wants it to be at 3%, the Fed can say 3% all day long at once. The market says, no, I'm not going to buy bonds unless it's 12%. Then what does the Fed have to do? The Fed has to jump in and buy the bonds. Fed says, okay, I'll buy them at 3%. And guess what happens when the Fed buys all these bonds at 3%? They're just flooding the market with money. They're flooding the economy with money because they're conjuring up money out of thin air, and they're buying all this government debt to keep the Social Security payments going, to keep the big militarism going, to keep the whole nanny state going, to keep the welfare state going, to keep all this fraud, waste, and abuse going. That's what they're going to do. Well, when the Fed starts buying up all these bonds and flooding the economy with money, what happens? A whole bunch more money chasing the same amount of stuff, and prices go up. That's called inflation. And the Fed is already signaling they're going to cut rates this month, September 2025, because there's a lot of pressure on them to do so. The numbers just came out. The unemployment numbers are going up. The jobs numbers are bad, and they revised it way back to June. The numbers are not good, and the Fed's likely going to cut interest rates, beginning a cutting cycle. So get ready for more inflation. That's what's likely going to happen. But they're between a rock and a hard place. Either they cut rates and inflate the currency and allow the government to continue to pay its bills, or they let rates rise, the government goes insolvent, they can't pay the bills, they can't send out the checks, and there's a major crisis. Either way, it's either inflation or it's default. One of the two. There's the position that they're in. So it won't be long, getting back to this whole retirement thing, it won't be long until those that have been sleeping in harvest are going to wake up in the dead of winter and realize that the shelves are bare, figuratively speaking. At that point, they're going to have to go back to work, not because they want to, but because they have to. Right? You have all these people that have been so-called retired for all these years, collecting a check from the government, and all of a sudden it's like, man, my check isn't, I can't pay my bills anymore. I don't have enough for groceries. I don't have enough for rent. I don't have enough for utilities. I can't make it anymore. I've got to go back to work. I don't want to go back to work. I have to go back to work. And that's what millions of Americans are going to find out, I believe, pretty soon. A lot of them already are. The American dream will be over, and it will be time to get back to reality. And it's going to be some bitter medicine to swallow. You know, people don't like work. People don't like going to work. I mean, human nature is people rather be doing something else than going to work. It's already not fun a lot of times to go to work. You know what's a lot less fun? When you've been having a good old time for the last 10 years, and now, oh, I got to go back to work. And guess what? I'm not some young whippersnapper of 65 like I used to be. Now I'm 75, and now I got to go back to work and work full time. And that's going to be a really bitter tasting medicine for a lot of people. This has been happening for years, but I think it will begin to happen a lot more in the coming years. 12 plus years ago, when I was working at an engineering firm, there was at least a couple of older men that I remember that came back to work. They had retired. Couldn't do it. Couldn't make it. They came back to work. Not because they wanted to, but because they had to. When I was driving a school bus 7 years ago, there was a guy working there, driving bus. Not because he wanted to. You think he wanted to drive a bunch of bratty kids around? Heck no, he didn't want to. He couldn't make it on his Social Security anymore. Had to come back to work. Like I said, they didn't do it because they wanted to. They did it because they had to. There's going to be a lot of people in their 60s, 70s, and even 80s coming back into the labor force competing with younger people for jobs. I am certain of it. You're going to see a lot of old people working that you would have never expected to see working. But the sad thing is they're not going to get the high-paying jobs that they had when they retired. They're probably going to have to settle for a lot less desirable jobs due to their advanced age and diminishing abilities. So they're not going to go back to that nice desk job that they had, that nice corporate job, that nice job where they were making six figures or making really good money. No, they're going to go be a greeter at Walmart for $12 an hour or whatever, $15 an hour, whatever they're paying, or whatever. They're going to be doing some menial job and making a fraction of what they used to. Now, if they would have been like the ant that we read about in Proverbs 6, that had been like the ant and laid up during the summer and worked diligently during the harvest of life, they would be able to rest during the end of their lives when they truly are at a point when they can't work or they can barely work. But instead of being like the ant and laying up during the harvest, they decided to kick back for a few years. Well, that few years is going to cost you, sadly. And it is sad, but decisions have consequences. Now, retirement, of course, if you haven't prepared for it financially yourself, retirement is bad for your finances. I probably don't have to tell anybody that, right? If you have no income coming in, it's not good for your finances, unless you have a large nest egg and you can live off the income that it produces, right? But retirement's not good for your finances, obviously, but it's also bad for your health and your well-being. I'm going to read you an article here. This is from Brian Borzakowski. It's an article called, "Can Retirement Kill You?" This is from back in 2013. It's from the BBC. I thought this was interesting. Shouldn't really come as a surprise to much of anybody. In 2003, Dr. Harry Prozan stepped down as head of psychiatry at the Medical College of Wisconsin. But the then 71-year-old had no plans to retire. Rather, the doctor intended to focus on other, quote, jobs, unquote, that would keep him busy. Okay, did you get that? The guy who was 71-year-old, head of psychiatry, stepped down, but he was going to work at other things to keep him busy. Okay. Now 83, Prozan still sees several patients, consults for a number of organizations, recently reviewed a 600-page manuscript for a friend, and regularly pores over a handful of medical journals just because he, quote, just wants to keep up, unquote, he said. It's not just a love of working that has kept Prozan toiling away 30 hours a week as an octogenarian. Octogenarian, somebody in their 80s. He also sees keeping busy as a matter of life or death. Prozan said he is certain that if he stopped working early, he would literally die not long after. He could be onto something. A number of studies show that retirement is, in fact, bad for your health. A May 2013 report published by the London-based Institute of Economic Affairs found that retirement increased the chances of suffering from depression by 40%, while it increased the probability of having at least one diagnosed physical ailment by about 60%. That impact was assessed after controlling for the usual age-related conditions. Like I said, it shouldn't really come as a surprise that retirement would increase depression. Some people may think, well, why would I be depressed? I get to just do whatever I want and have fun. Well, it's because man was made to work. Man was made to be productive and do things and have a sense of accomplishment. And this is what happens to a lot of men when they retire. They have no sense of accomplishment anymore. They also have no, their work was where they had respect. They had authority there. They had respect. They had accomplishment. They had, there's all kinds of good things that were beneficial to them from work. Just getting up and moving around and doing things and having some place to go every day and things like that. It's no wonder that a lot of men suffer from depression after they stop. I mean, just sitting around doing nothing, that would be depressing to me. Anyway, the article continues. Gabriel Salgren, director of research at the Center for Market Reform of Education and author of the IEA report, was surprised by just how much retirement undermined health. He looked at 9,000 people across 11 European Union countries and found that across borders, people suffered in the same ways and to similar degrees. In the first year of retirement, health actually improved. Quote, it's nice to get some rest from work, he said. But 2 or 3 years later, retirees' mental and physical conditions began deteriorating. Other studies have shown similar results. Between 1992 and 2005, Davil Dave, an associate professor of economics at Bentley University in Waltham, Massachusetts, looked at 12,000 Americans and found that, on average, people experience some sort of ailment within 6 years of retiring. Hypertension, heart disease, stroke, and arthritis are common physical ailments, Dave said. He, too, found that depression increases after retirement. Now, obviously, older people get these kind of things, but it's a study. He's comparing a retired group of old people to a non-retired group of old people the same age and seeing the retired people actually have more health problems than the non-retired people. Though retirement ages may differ from country to country, in China, men retire at 60. In India, people retire between 60 and 65, and in Norway, it's closer to 67. Studies done in other nations have produced comparable findings. Health problems, both physical and mental, are exacerbated by retirement, whether a retiree is 65 or 75. And that makes sense to me. I believe what I'm reading because it just resonates in my soul. That makes sense. Now, there is a retirement that is biblical. You will find this in the Bible. And that retirement is called death. Revelation 14 and verse 13. Here is the Lord's retirement program. He's got a retirement program planned and provided for every one of us. Every single one of us has a retirement program in our future. Revelation 14 and verse 13. And I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, write, blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth. Yea, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, and their works do follow them. They may rest from their labors. When do we finally get to rest from laboring? When we die. Now, Revelation 6 and verse 11. Revelation 6 and verse 11. Except, I'll get to this in a minute, when you die and go on to heaven, you still don't stop working. We're still going to work up there. Thank the Lord. Can you imagine if heaven was like most people's conception of it, where you're sitting on a cloud strumming a harp for all eternity or something? Thank the Lord we're going to get to work and do something productive. Only work won't be frustrating and irritating and disappointing and all the things that it is here sometimes. Revelation 6 and verse 11. And this is speaking of the martyrs. And white robes were given unto every one of them, and it was said unto them that they should rest yet for a little season, until their fellow servants also and their brethren that should be killed as they were should be fulfilled. So yeah, they should rest a little while. They're taking their retirement. In fact, these folks here took early retirement. You know that? They were martyrs. They died earlier than they normally would have. They got to take early retirement. And then Isaiah 57, 1 through 2. Isaiah 57, 1 through 2. Don't feel bad for people who get to take early retirement in this context. Isaiah 57, 1 through 2. The righteous perisheth, and no man layeth it to heart. And merciful men are taken away, none considering that the righteous is taken away from the evil to come. We often don't think about that. We just think about how sad it is the person died. But if you think about it, all the evil to come that person was taken away from. Now, I mean, that could be things that happen in the world and all that, or it could just be simple, the evil to come, you know, getting cancer and dying of some horrible disease or having a lot of pain or getting Alzheimer's or dementia or something and losing your mind or witnessing, you know, tragedies and calamities happening to your children or your family or whatever. There's all kinds of things, right? That people that die, they're taken away from all this evil to come. They don't have to deal with all this stuff that we do. And look at what it says here. He shall enter into peace. They shall rest in their beds, each one walking in his uprightness. There's your retirement. You get to rest. Rest in your bed. But like I said, even this retirement is not sitting around all day doing nothing and living a life of leisure. Here's a quote from Randy Alcorn in his book Heaven. I talked about this in the Heaven series, if you remember. He writes, since work began before sin and the curse, and since God, who is without sin, is a worker, we should assume human beings will work on the new earth. We should assume we'll be able to resume the work started by Adam and Eve, exercising godly dominion over the earth, ruling it for God's glory. Because it does say that the second coming of Christ will be the restitution of all things, so it gets restored to the way it was in the beginning. But we don't need to just assume this. Scripture directly tells us, when the faithful servant enters heaven, he is offered not retirement, but this, quote, well done, thou good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord. Matthew 25:23. The Lord doesn't say, well done, thou good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will now let thee kick back in a recliner for all eternity and sit there and do nothing. He didn't say that, does he? No, he says, I'll make thee ruler over many things, which means you're going to have stuff to do. And it's true, we will work in heaven, both in the present heaven and in the new earth. And that work will include serving God, building houses, planting vineyards, and working with our own hands. Let me give you some verses here. Revelation 7:13-15. So you always want to remember, work is not a result of the curse. Adam and Eve had work to do in the garden. Right? God told them to dress and keep the trees of the garden. So they had work to do. It wasn't like God, after Adam sinned, said, all right, now you're going to dress and keep that garden. No, no. They dressed and kept the garden before sin ever entered into the world. So don't ever get this idea that work is some evil thing, it's punishment or something. It's not at all. Work's actually a blessing, especially when it's good, productive work that you enjoy. Now, Revelation 7:13-15. Let me just jump down to verse 15. He's talking about here these people in white robes. And verse 15, therefore are they before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple, and he that sitteth on the throne shall dwell among them. So here are people in heaven. This is the present heaven. This is before the second coming, before the new earth. But here God's saints are in heaven serving him day and night. That's work. Revelation 22:3. This is after the resurrection. And there shall be no more curse, but the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it, and his servants shall serve him. So we'll be serving God. And then in Isaiah 65:21, it says we'll be building houses and planting vineyards. Isaiah 65:21. This is a prophecy of the new heavens and a new earth. And it says, and they shall build houses and inhabit them, and they shall plant vineyards and eat the fruit of them. And also, we'll be working with our hands. Next verse, verse 22. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. For as the days of a tree are the days of my people, and mine elect shall long enjoy the work of their hands. So, not only are they working, they're enjoying it. Right? It's a blessing to work. And then we'll labor with our hands. Verse 23, they shall not labor in vain, nor bring forth for trouble, for they are the seed of the blessed of the Lord, and their offspring with them. So yeah, working is not just something for this earth. It's not a punishment. Working is a good thing. So if you don't like to work, you better learn to quickly, because work's never going to end. Now, I mentioned earlier that there are a couple of other types of retirement that I have no problem with, and I think from my understanding of the Bible, there'd be no biblical problem with this either. The first is what I call natural retirement. As a man gets older and weaker, he should naturally do less work, especially physically and mentally demanding and intensive work. That just makes sense, right? As you get older and weaker and you have less and less mental capacity, you do less and less. It would be ridiculous to expect an 80-year-old man to do the exact same work, the exact same hours, the exact same amount of work as a 30-year-old man. That's crazy, right? Of course. The older you get, it should just be a natural progression. You just get older, you get tired, you're like, you know, I got to cut back my hours a little bit here. I just can't do it anymore. I'm just too tired, right? And then, you know, maybe you're back to halftime, and then maybe you're just back to working one day a week or whatever you're doing. But, you know, it's just a natural progression. That's the way it should work. And the thing is, you want to remember, and I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but you know people age differently. You ever notice that? I mean, there are some people in their late 60s that are like pretty much wheelchair bound. I mean, walking with a walker, in terrible health, barely get around, right? There are other people in their late 60s that look like they're in their 40s, right? Or at least act like they're in their 40s, and they've got all kinds of energy. Just, you know, they haven't changed in years. There's people in their 80s that some of them are still going strong, can sharp as a tack, work all day long. There are other people that in their 80s that have been sitting in a wheelchair or in a nursing home for 5 years, right? Can't do anything. So age is, I mean, it's people age very differently. So there's no set thing here. It's not like, well, when you hit this age, then you can start to slow down a little bit. Well, maybe. Maybe when you hit 65, you can start to slow down. Maybe when you hit 65, you've got 10 good solid years left where you could really go out there and produce a lot, make a big difference in the world, and rack up a ton of money for you and your family to live off of. Other people at 65, I mean, they're pretty much, you know, pushing a walker, right? And they can't hardly do anything. So there's no set age for these kind of things. But if a man lives long enough, you know, he may get to the point where he's just incapable of doing anything that would qualify as work, right? And that's fine. My grandmother's going to be 92. Now, she's a woman. I'm talking about men when I'm talking about retiring and working and all that stuff. But my grandma's 92. Let's say she was a man. She could not work. She could not go out and get a job, period. It is absolutely impossible for her to go out and get a job doing anything. That's fine. But you know what? She keeps her house. She gets herself food ready every day. The house is nice and clean and neat. I mean, she still does what she can, even though she can barely do anything. Walks around all stooped over in a walker. But yeah, that's fine. That kind of retirement, that's perfectly natural. But this is completely different from the American idea of reaching a magic age and quitting one's job and not working at all when one is still in good health and capable of being productive. Now, there's also what I call earned retirement. And I think this is fine also. If a man's in his, could even be in his 50s, 60s, 70s, if you've saved $1 million plus, you got $1 million in your nest egg and your investments, and you can live on those investments for the rest of your life, and you want to quit a stressful job and work a different full-time or a part-time job that's less demanding, that's fine. I don't think there's anything wrong with that at all. You could even choose to quit work and keep busy with volunteering or helping friends and family, spending time with grandchildren. You could just choose to stop working. If you got $1 million in investments, $1 million, if you were making, say, 8% interest, that's $80,000 a year. You could live comfortably on $80,000 a year. It wouldn't be growing anymore, but, you know, you could live off of the income. But then again, you'd have to be in the stock market to do that. And when you're in your retirement years, it might not be a good idea to have it in the stock market where it could have a big drop at some point. So if you take that million and you put it in something more conservative, like bonds or like CDs or something at 4% interest, now you're down to $40,000 a year income on $1 million. $40,000 a year, yeah, doable these days. You're not going to be doing much of anything, really. You could exist on it. You could survive on it if you had no house payment, if you had no payments at all, no debt. But, you know, that's what I mean. Oh, $1 million, I'm a millionaire. Yeah, big deal. You're a millionaire. That means you can live a subsistence lifestyle if you don't want to spend $1 million and get down to zero, right? So even $1 million is not, you know, it's not that big of a deal, really, these days. But anyway, yeah, if you had $1 million plus and you're whatever age and you want to stop working and do whatever you want, well, you know what? You have earned the right to do that, literally. You have literally earned the right to do that. You have earned that money. You have been diligent, disciplined. You have sacrificed. You have underconsumed your entire life. You've been wise and invested. You have earned the right to stop working because you can take a portion of your labor, essentially. Your money is your labor, right? That's where you got it. You can take a portion of your labor. What you basically did is labored a whole bunch, and you put a big stockpile of labor here that you now can take from. You're basically living on your past labor. You have worked and earned, and therefore you have the right to stop working if you'd like to. But if you have not saved enough to live off of for the rest of your life, you have not earned the right to retire. You know, people think everybody's got a right to retire. No, everybody doesn't. Nobody has the right to retire that does not have enough money laid up to live off of that money for the rest of his life. You have not earned the right to retire if you have not done that. Just like you haven't earned the right to buy a car if you don't have the $20,000 to write out the check. You haven't earned the right to buy a Big Mac if you don't have $6 in your pocket or whatever. I don't know what a Big Mac costs, but whatever. You haven't earned the right to anything unless you have the money for it. You haven't earned the right to retire unless you've got the money that you can live on for the rest of your life. And since you don't know how long the rest of your life is, that's got to be a lot of money because you could live for 20 or 30 years. What you don't have the right to is other people's money. Anybody that says you've worked for a long time, you have the right to retire and get a check from some, from the government or whatever. You know what they're saying? You have a right to other people's money. That's what they're telling you. You have a right. No, you don't. You do not have a right to other people's money. You have a right to your own money, and that's it. Now, if a person decided to do that, 50, 60, 70, whatever, you know, you got enough money laid up now, you decided to stop working, you can do that, but you will miss out on the blessing and the personal fulfillment of doing productive labor if you choose to take earned retirement. You will actually probably have a less fulfilled life because you will not have that sense of accomplishment anymore. I'm not saying you have to work full time or something. You got $1 million laid up and you worked and earned all that and invested it, and you want to work part time, half time, or something like that, you know, whatever, that's fine. But I'm just saying, if you stop working entirely, you're going to miss out on probably a lot of blessing in your life. But that's every man's decision to make for himself, if he's in that position. Now, I'm going to finish off the section on retirement with three quotes that I like here. The first one's from a guy named Max Asnas. He says, "Money is something you got to make in case you don't die." I would say you have to save and invest in case you don't die. But yeah, money is something you got to make in case you don't die. Have you ever heard this saying? It's a common one. You probably have. There's different versions of it. But behind every successful man is a supportive woman. You ever hear that? Behind every good man is a good woman, or something like that. Well, I saw this one. It was on a sign in a restaurant back home, and I thought it was really good. I really like it. It says, "Behind every retired man is a wife wishing he would go back to work." I think that that is universally true of 100% of all women on the planet. I believe that is the case. If I'm wrong, anybody hearing the sound of my voice on recording or in person, please tell me. I don't think I'm wrong. I think I'm absolutely, I think that whoever said this is absolutely right 100% of the time. "Behind every retired man is a wife wishing he would go back to work." I even heard of a Christian woman. Her husband retired. He was home for a few days or weeks, walking around the house, getting in her hair, driving her crazy. And she said, "If you don't leave this house and do something, I'm going to kill you." Yep. Almost all of you know who that woman was, actually. And then Alex Comfort said, "2 weeks is about the ideal length of time to retire." And I think that's probably about right. I know for me, 2 weeks of sitting around doing nothing, and I'd be ready to get out there and get working, get doing something. All right, now let's talk about leaving an inheritance. Like I said, I'm going in logical order here, so this is the last thing that you do, right? You leave an inheritance. Most people do that after they die. You can do it before you die, but most people do that after they die. So this is the last thing. Leaving an inheritance. And this is biblical. Let's look at Deuteronomy 21, 16 through 17. Deuteronomy 21, 16 through 17. Now, there are socialists and communists out there that think leaving an inheritance is evil. That just perpetuates inequality because wealthy people leave their money to their children, and then their children are wealthy. But it's biblical. It's a good thing to do. Heck of a lot better than leaving it to the government to go out and waste it. Deuteronomy 21, 16 through 17. "Then it shall be, when he maketh his sons to inherit that which he hath, that he may not make the son of the beloved firstborn before the son of the hated, which is indeed the firstborn. Verse 17, but he shall acknowledge the son of the hated for the firstborn by giving him a double portion of all that he hath, for he is the beginning of his strength, the right of the firstborn is his. So even if he liked another son better, had a son from a different wife and he liked better, he had to give a double portion to the firstborn. So yes, inheritance is biblical. The Bible teaches us that in Old and New Testament that parents are to lay up for their children. Proverbs 19 and verse 14. Proverbs 19:14. It says, house and riches are the inheritance of fathers, and a prudent wife is from the Lord. House and riches are the inheritance of fathers. They're what fathers give to their children. 2 Chronicles 21 and verse 3. 2 Chronicles 21 and verse 3. Parents are to lay up for the children, not children for the parents. There are unbiblical cultures out there that think that children ought to be laying up for the parents. It's not right. I mean, yeah, they ought to help them if in their time of need, if they have to, if they need it. But you don't. Some cultures think you have children just so the moment they get out of the house, you can stop working, be a bum, and have them support you for the rest of your life. It's ridiculous. 2 Chronicles 21 and verse 3. And their father gave them great gifts of silver and of gold and of precious things with fenced cities in Judah. But the kingdom gave he to Jehoram because he was the firstborn. This is King Jehoshaphat. Gave to his children silver and gold and precious things. Right? He gave them an inheritance. And then 2 Corinthians 12 and verse 14. And this one sums it up quite well. 2 Chronicles 12:14. Behold, the third time I am ready to come to you, Paul writes to the Corinthians, and I will not be burdensome to you, for I seek not yours, but you. For the children ought not to lay up for the parents, but the parents for the children. He's using this principle. He's using it figuratively. He's their father in the ministry or in the faith. But he's basing it on a worldly principle here that parents ought to lay up for the children, not children for the parents. Children are not supposed to lay up for the parents, like this verse says. However, children are supposed to take care of their aging parents if they cannot take care of themselves. Let's look at Mark 7, 10 through 13. But this should only happen after a parent has done everything he can for his entire life to provide for himself and his wife. And then if you've done everything that you can and you've lived wise and frugally and you've run out of money at the end of your life, you've outlived your money, then your children can and should help you out. But children should not feel obligated to help out parents who have buildings full of crap that they could sell and cars and whatever else and say, you know what, I'm really having a hard time paying the electric bill. Tough. Sell your stuff off. I mean, are you kidding me? Like, you'd expect your children to pay your bills for you when you've got all kinds of stuff that you could sell. I'm not talking about the house that you're living in, but you've got all kinds of stuff you could sell and you want to be a burden on your children? That's not right. Mark 7, 10 through 13. For Moses said, honor thy father and thy mother, and whosoever curseth father or mother, let him die the death. But ye say, if a man shall say to his father or mother, it is korban, that is to say a gift, by whatsoever thou mightest be profited by me, he shall be free. And ye suffer him not to do aught for his father or his mother. We've been over this passage many times, but the Pharisees had come up with this system, this korban system. They would give it all to the temple in trust. And they didn't technically own any of it. And then when their parents were old and infirmed and needed their help, they say, sorry, it's a gift. I've already given it to the temple. I've given it to God. I can't help you. Right? That is wrong. That is wrong. When your parents are in need, truly in need, not that they want to build an addition onto their house or something so they have a spare bedroom or something like that. When your parents are truly in need, we should help them out. First Timothy 5 and verse 4. 1 Timothy 5 and verse 4. But if any widow have children or nephews, let them first learn to show piety at home and to requite, that is to repay, their parents, for that is good and acceptable before God. Yeah, the widow, children or nephews, so even extended family ought to be there to help out parents or uncles and aunts. And that was the thing back, you know, before just a few years ago, people used to have lots of kids. You had two people with tons of kids, and those tons of kids could easily take care of two people, right? You got five or six people can easily take care of one couple, right? Now you got, you know, people, one kid, no kids, whatever, and, you know, it's pretty tough. Even if you have two kids, two people trying to take care of one couple is a big burden if you're trying to take care of all their needs, right? When you had six or eight or ten kids, you know, not such a big deal. And then not to mention all these grandkids. I mean, you know, people in the past would have more grandkids than they can count. All you'd have to do is just get the family together. You got one group of old people, grandma and grandpa. You've got six or eight kids, dozens of grandkids. Everybody contributes just a little wee bit, and you can easily take care of grandma and grandpa, right? No big deal. Nowadays, you know, people have one or no kids and maybe a grandchild. If they're lucky, you know, good luck. Then what? You know, relying on the government or something. It's a messed up world. 1 Timothy 5 and verse 8. But if any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own house, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. So yeah, we have to take care of our own parents, our own families, our own wives, children, our own people in our own sphere. We need to do that. And verse 16, but if a man or woman that believeth have widows, let them relieve them, and let not the church be charged, that it may relieve them that are widows indeed. So yes, we have a responsibility to take care of our parents. But you know, look at this widow here. Verse 5. Now she that is a widow indeed and desolate trusteth in God. She's desolate. She doesn't have anything, right? That's when you're required to step up and give your parents money, when they're desolate, when they need it. Now, I say to everybody, regardless of your age, be wise with your money so that you will not be a burden to your children or to society when you get old. And I know for me, that is a very important thing to me. It is constantly on my mind. I don't know if it's because I'm a man. I think that's part of it. Men, at least should, and I'm not the only one. I've heard other people talk about this. Men have a constant burden in the back of their minds to provide. Constantly, there's a weight on men's shoulders that it's my responsibility to provide for this family. And I have it is constantly on my mind, very important to me, to never be a burden to anybody, whether I had children or whether it was extended family or it was society or who, or the church, whatever. I really do not want to be a burden on anybody. And that is constantly in my mind when I make my financial plans, when I think about the future. Now, a good man will save enough not only to leave an inheritance to his children, but to his children's children, to his grandchildren. Proverbs 13 and verse 22. Proverbs 13 and verse 22. A good man leaveth an inheritance to his children's children, and the wealth of the sinner is laid up for the just. So there's one of maybe 6, 7, 8 places in the Bible which talks about a good man. A good man does thus and so. There's a bunch of them. I've covered them and I've written about them and I've preached about them. But this is one. A good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children, to his grandchildren. That could be a nice boost. You know, because your children, chances are, especially if you had children young and you live till you're old, by the time you die, your kids are old, right? Your kids could easily be in their 60s or 50s. They ought to have their ducks in a row. I was going to say something more vulgar. But anyway, they ought to have their ducks in a row by that age. It ought to just be icing in the cake at that point, you know, an inheritance. But to the grandchildren, that can really help you, you know, help you with a down payment on your first house or whatever, right? That could be a real blessing for a younger person that's just starting out in life. Now here's the thing. When you leave a monetary inheritance to children, you want to do it in conjunction with teaching them to manage money prudently, and that will result in generational wealth. If you leave your children an inheritance, it's only going to benefit them if you teach them to manage money wisely. Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 11. Now the thing is though, you had to have done the teaching long before you leave the inheritance, because like I said, chances are your children are going to be grown adults by the time you leave them an inheritance. Your teaching has long been over. You had to have taught them years and years and years ago to be responsible adults. And if you didn't, well, then you may as well forget about leaving them an inheritance if you want it to be a blessing. Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 11 says, "Wisdom is good with an inheritance, and by it there is profit to them that see the sun." Wisdom is good with an inheritance. An inheritance is good with wisdom. But an inheritance is not so good if the person receiving it doesn't have wisdom. But like I said, you got to start young. You got to start when your kids are toddlers, and you have to teach them good money management the whole way until they're out of the house. Start when they're toddlers. I mean, just wee little. I mean, they hardly even understand what money is, and they got their little coin. You put this one in the save, you put this one in the spend, you put this one in the give, or whatever. You start teaching them that from the time they're little kids, and then you incrementally, as they get older, you give them more and more responsibility, get them their own checking accounts when they become teenagers or right around there, a little, maybe a little earlier, and teach them how to manage their own money and teach them how to save, teach them how to invest, get them a custodial Roth IRA. That's a great thing to do. Braden, tell your parents to get you a custodial Roth IRA. You don't even know what that is? They might not either, but tell them to come talk to me. Get a custodial Roth IRA. You can't have an IRA when you're under 18. You can't legally sign for anything. But when you get a job, they have to get a real job. You can't, you know, working for the neighbors doesn't count on this one. When you get a real job and you get a paycheck, then any income that you make, you can put in that Roth IRA. And that money will build in there for your retirement until you're 59 and a half, and it goes in tax-free, and you don't pay any tax on any of the gains. So when you put money in there, when you're just a little tyke like you are now, and someday at 59 and a half when you're a multimillionaire, you don't pay one dime of tax on any of that money. You take it, and you take out any of it you want, you don't pay any tax on it. It's a great deal. And the really cool thing is, when you're young like you are, you won't be paying any tax on your income until you get to a certain threshold. So you can probably work until you're 18 or more. You won't make enough money to pay taxes anyway. So you'll be paying no tax. You'll be putting money in there that you didn't pay tax on. It'll be growing tax-free, and you'll never pay taxes on it when you take it out. So you will have never paid a dime of tax on those multiple millions that you'll have in your Roth IRA if you start now at your age and keep contributing to that thing steadily for your entire life. And you think I'm kidding. I'm not. I'm not. Here's what Ramsey had to say on this topic in his book, Baby Steps Millionaires. That said, there's nothing wrong, quote unquote, with being a spender. Sure, he's talking about your kids, whether they're spenders or savers and that kind of thing. Sure, spenders can be impulsive, but they can also be incredibly generous. And there's nothing, quote, right, unquote, about being a saver. Savers can tend to be more patient and responsible, but they can also be stingy. We are all wired one way or the other. The goal is to understand the personalities of our kids so we can teach them how to find the balance and be wise spenders and savers. I've mentioned this before, and I don't have a quote here, but I've mentioned this before, that people worry about, if I give my kids an inheritance, am I going to ruin them? Not if you have trained them well up until adulthood. If you've trained them well, they'll be just fine with it. It's not going to ruin them. But if you haven't trained them well, and they're a bunch of lazy, entitled brats that are impulsive and can't save money, can't, you know, just blow money and have to have instant gratification for everything. Well, yeah, you leave them a bunch of money, yeah, you're going to ruin them, of course. But if you've raised them right, you don't have to worry. You can give them $10 million. It's not going to hurt them in the slightest. It's just going to magnify who they are, and that is a good person. But if you didn't raise them right, yeah, that $10 million will ruin them. Absolutely. It'll manifest what they are, a spoiled, rotten brat. Now, if you don't teach your children to manage money wisely, then don't bother giving them an inheritance because it's going to quickly be gone. Let me give you a couple of verses. Proverbs 20 and verse 21. Proverbs 20 and verse 21. An inheritance may be gotten hastily at the beginning, but the end thereof shall not be blessed. Yep. It comes in fast. And it's all exciting and it's really cool to get it. And guess what? It's gone in a heartbeat. If you haven't been taught well. Yeah, and we all know the story of the prodigal son. We've been over that one. Remember the younger son says, "Give me what befalleth to me," and his father divides out his living to him and his brother, and then he goes off into a land and he wastes it with riotous living, and then he comes into want and ends up eating with the pigs, and then comes to himself and decides to go back and be a hired servant in his father's house. Right, but that man was never apparently taught anything, and that inheritance was harmful to him, not helpful. Because what's going to happen is if you don't teach your kids to manage money wisely and you give them an inheritance, you're just going to all that it's all going to be wasted. All of your labor, your thrift, your diligent investing, your wise living, all of that will be for naught. You're just going to give it to somebody who's just going to blow it. How sad would that be? Solomon writes about that in Ecclesiastes. Now, here's one that you might not have thought about before. But a parent is not obliged to leave all of his wealth to his children. Let's look at Proverbs 17 and verse 2. You don't have to leave all of your wealth to your children. Now, if they're good kids, you should leave them an inheritance. I mean, it is biblical to leave an inheritance, but you don't have to leave it all to your children. I'm not saying you shouldn't. It just depends on the circumstances. But Proverbs 17 and verse 2 says, "A wise servant shall have rule over a son that causeth shame and shall have part of the inheritance among the brethren." Here, this man, this father, had children and he had a wise servant and he left part of the inheritance to the servant. Nothing wrong with that. And if you have rebellious children, they don't deserve anything. Proverbs 11 and verse 29. Proverbs 11 and verse 29. He that troubleth his own house shall inherit the wind, and the fool shall be servant to the wise of heart. He'll inherit the wind, which that's a way of saying he's going to have nothing. What do you have if you inherit the wind? The wind blows, and you're going to try to grab a piece of it, right? You got nothing, right? It just blows on by. That's your inheritance if you trouble your own house. I have written beside that, this should be Uncle so-and-so's inheritance. I won't say his name publicly, but this should be Uncle so-and-so's inheritance. I had an uncle that should have inherited the wind, and it was a downright travesty that he inherited his portion of the estate. An absolute travesty. Man troubled his own house, shouldn't have got a thing. And the fool should be servant of the wise of heart. See? The foolish son is going to be servant to the good son that was wise, that got the inheritance. Now here's another one. You know that Jesus did not teach that we have to evenly divide the inheritance between the children? I mean, there are some people, parents, people out there that think that it's just, I have to evenly divide it. It doesn't matter if I've got, you know, 3 all-stars and 2 duds. I have to evenly divide it among them all. Because that's just not right to give one child more than another. Well, you're not thinking like the Son of God. I can tell you that much if you think that way. Luke 12, 13 through 14. Luke 12, 13 through 14. Luke 12, 13. And one of the company said unto him, "Master, speak to my brother that he divide the inheritance with me." Well, guess what? It sounds like that his brother got all the inheritance and this guy didn't get any. And he's like, "Hey, tell my brother to divide it up with me. I should get part of this too, right?" Now, if Jesus was a social justice warrior that people think, he would have said, well, yeah, you bring your brother over here, I'm going to tell him to give you half of that. But what did Jesus say? And he said unto him, man, who made me a judge or a divider over you? You know what Jesus is saying? This is none of my business. Apparently, your parents thought that your brother was more deserving of the inheritance than you are, and this is none of my business. I'm not going to take a dog by the ears, right? He that passeth by and meddleth with strife, belonging not to him, is like one that taketh the dog by the ears. Jesus says, I'm not going to get involved in this. This is none of my business. What he did not say is, well, yep, your parents were wrong. He should split up that inheritance with you. He didn't say that at all, did he? Now, personally, I would not leave an inheritance to a child or anyone else who has demonstrated that he cannot manage money well. Or I should say it would be a very exceptional circumstance that I would do so. I'll just put it that way. Those who are in debt, those who have little to no money saved, those who spend money foolishly would not be candidates to be heirs of mine. And this would include my own children if I had any. And you could say, well, you don't have any. You don't know what you're talking about. You might be right, but I strongly suspect that this is where my principles would take me. I strongly suspect that. Now, if you choose to not leave an inheritance to one of your children, do the right and the difficult thing and tell him that he's not in the will. This is where they really make mistakes. And I've heard this on the Ramsey show many times. A parent wants to leave the inheritance to one of their children or to some of their children and not to one or more of their children. But the parent doesn't have the guts to tell the wayward son or daughter, I'm not leaving you anything. So the parent just puts it in the will and figures, they'll find out when I'm dead. Takes the easy way out. Well, that's fine and dandy, except who is that child going to hate after you're dead? Well, maybe you, but who cares? You're dead, right? But who is that child going to hate? His siblings. He's going to blame it on the siblings. Oh, it was those wicked siblings. They probably talked mom and dad, or they talked dad into not giving me anything, right? Be a man and tell that child, you're not in the will. I'm sorry, you have lived like a fool, you have not lived wisely, you have disrespected me, whatever the situation is, you're not in the will. Sorry. You're not getting anything. And it's not your brothers and sisters' fault, and don't blame them. It's your fault. Do the right thing if you're going to do that. This will potentially save your other children a lot of headache and heartache because the sibling would end up blaming them, as I said. And this could also give the child a second chance to amend his ways before you die. If you sit him down and say, you know what? You're a drug addict. You're an alcoholic. You're a whatever. I am not leaving you an inheritance. It'll kill you, literally. Or you're just going to blow it. You're going to lose it. You're going to, you know, whatever. You're going to do with it things that I would not approve of. I'm sorry. I'm not giving you any inheritance. And maybe that child would seriously think, you know, he's right. And I'd really like to get that money. I'm going to straighten up my act, right? I'm going to start doing the right thing. I'm going to quit drinking. I'm going to quit smoking weed. I'm going to whatever. I'm going to quit living like an idiot. I'm going to cut up my credit cards and pay them off or whatever. It might actually cause the child to change his ways before you die, and that'd be a great thing. Now, personally, I'd much rather leave my hard-earned money, which was acquired by years of labor, discipline, and self-denial, and the blessing of God, I hasten to add, most importantly. I'd rather leave that to a wealthy person who would manage it and use it wisely rather than to a lazy, undisciplined, poor person who would squander it. And I have Bible for that. Remember the parable of the pounds and the talents. In Matthew 25, I've been over it many times, so I'm not going to go over it again. I've been over it many times in this series. Take from him the pound and give it to him that hath 10 pounds, to him that hath 10 talents, right? And the servant said, but Lord, he hath 10 pounds. That doesn't matter. Give it to him. To him that hath, much will be given. More will be given. That's what I think anyway. Now, there is another type of inheritance that you can leave to your children. That is passing down the faith to them, to your children and grandchildren. That's a good inheritance. Deuteronomy 4 and verse 9. Deuteronomy 4 and verse 9. Deuteronomy 4:9. Only take heed to thyself, and keep thy soul diligently, lest thou forget the things which thine eyes have seen, and lest they depart from thine heart, from thy heart, all the days of thy life. But teach them thy sons and thy sons' sons. So your children and grandchildren. That is a great inheritance, to leave them the faith, to teach them the word of God, to teach them about the Lord. That's a great inheritance. However, this is not a replacement for leaving your children and grandchildren a monetary inheritance. It's great. It's a better inheritance to leave them the word of God, to leave them the faith, to teach them godliness. That is the greater inheritance. But that is not an excuse to leave them the lesser inheritance of a monetary inheritance. Do not use this as a cop-out to shirk your responsibility. Well, I may not be able to leave my kids and grandkids any money, but I will pass down the faith to them. That's great. You want to do the greater, but don't leave the lesser undone. You remember what Jesus said to the Pharisees? Ye pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin and have omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. These ought you to have done, that is the greater ones, judgment, mercy, and faith, and not to have left the other undone. Right? He didn't say, you know what? You just got to work on judgment, mercy, and faith and forget about tithing the mint, anise, and cumin. No, he said, do the greater ones, do the judgment, mercy, and faith, and tithe the mint, anise, and cumin. Right? Don't leave the lesser undone either. Don't let this be an excuse, because people will do this. All right, while I'm on this topic, I want to exhort you again. I did this in the series called Dealing with Death, I think. We talked about making a will, getting all your last things in order and all that. Make a will. For the sake of everything that is just and decent and good, make a will. It's irresponsible to die without a will. Or if you have a trust, then maybe you don't need a will, however that works. But anyway, you get what I'm saying. It's irresponsible to die without a will. If you have worked hard your whole life acquiring wealth, why would you want to leave it up to the state to determine who gets it? You know that's what happens. When you die without a will, it's not like, well, you know, my family will just get to divide it up. No, they won't. They will not just get to divide it up. Not legally. I mean, they may go in there and try to do that, and if nobody contests it, maybe they'll get away with it. But if there's any fight about it whatsoever, and if there's anything with names, like bank accounts and all that, and there's names on things, no, they don't just divide it up. If you don't have a will, it goes to the state, and some judge determines where your stuff goes. He may give it to the people that you wanted it to, given to. He may not. You have no idea. Don't die without a will. That's insane. You can make a will for free online, and you can have it notarized very inexpensively. As a matter of fact, you can take it down to the courthouse and have it notarized for free. You can literally make a will for 100% free. I've done it myself. You don't even need an attorney. The internet's going to put attorneys out of business. If the internet doesn't do it, AI definitely will, but or a lot of attorneys anyway. You don't need to pay hundreds of dollars to an attorney unless you have, if you have some massive estate or something complicated. But if you have a simple estate like a lot of people do, make it yourself online. And if you happen to make one, I don't know if you know this or not, if you happen to make one, if you lived in a previous state and your will was made in that state, it is null and void. If you live here, you have to make the will in the state that in which you live. Ramsey said in his book, The Total Money Makeover, estate planners tell us that 70% of Americans die without a will. That is insane. That's nuts. But I don't doubt it's true, but it's crazy. He goes on to say, a will is a gift you leave your family or loved ones. It is a gift because it makes the management of your estate very clear and light years easier. You are going to die, so go out in style and die with a will in place. And then lastly, this is another just a practical thing. You can do it or not do it. It's not going to bother me. As a matter of fact, I am not the estate of any... What is it called? Executor. Thank you. I am not the executor of any of your estates, so I don't really care if you want to leave a huge mess and screw whoever is, right? But if you care about the people that are your executors, get yourself a knockbox. And you think, what is a knockbox? A knock box is a next of kin box. That's what knock stands for. It's actually a thing. It's a thing. I got one myself, so I'm not telling you to do anything I haven't done. When I heard about it, I told my mother about it, and she bought one. She checked it out before I did. And thankfully, my mother's kind of like me, and she's very detail-oriented and just has to get stuff done and checked off her list, and she did the whole thing. Took her a while, but she filled up the entire knock box, filled out the whole thing, and so I've got this box. I'm her executor. One of these days, it's going to be so simple for me. I'm just going to pull out a box, and every single thing I need is in one box, all organized very nicely. It's a box that has pre-made folders for all of your important papers and everything your next of kin will need to take care of your estate when you're gone. And not only is it good for your next of kin, it's just good for you because it is one place where you can organize all of your stuff. You don't have to have things, I got it in this drawer, I've got it here, I've got it there, I've got it in the safe, I've got it in the filing cabinet. It's all in one place. And you just keep it updated all the time. Every time you get a new policy, every time you open up a new account, every time, whatever, anything that you do, you get some piece of mail that you would need to file away somewhere, it goes in the knock box. And the old one goes out if it's replacing it. It has folders and instructions for things like your house, so your mortgage, your lease, your utilities, you know, things that you never think about. If you died suddenly, especially if it's not your spouse that's taking over, in some cases, if it is your spouse, some spouses have no clue what's going on in the house, but that person may have no idea, like, what electric company do we use? What's our account number? I have no idea. I don't even know what to do. I have no idea, right? So all that stuff is in there. Vehicles, like titles, registration, maintenance records, bank accounts. You got one, you know, you got a folder for each bank account in there. Insurance policies. There'd be life insurance, homeowners insurance, vehicle insurance, all your insurance policies right there in one place. Investments, all your different, you know, your 401k, your Roth IRA, your SEP IRA, your whatever, your brokerage account, whatever you have, your annuity, all your investments, all in one place. Debt. This folder should be empty. If I ever happen to peek in any of your knock boxes and I see anything in the debt folder, I'm going to have an aneurysm at this point. Income. So that would be probably things like your W-2s, maybe if you signed a contract when you first started working there, or whatever, anything income related, right? A copy of one of your pay stubs, just so they know where your paycheck's coming from, what bank account it's going into, right? Anything that somebody would need to know regarding your income. Assets, you know, whatever that might be, could be anything. Family, friends, and pets. I never even thought about this. I'm not a pet person, but if you had a pet, that's a big deal to most people. And you'd want to leave instructions there of what to do with your pets or your animals, right? Education and career, like past employment records, transcripts and diplomas, military service records, you know, your DD-214, stuff like that. That would go in that folder. Health, like your current and past medical records, Medicare, you know, that kind of stuff. Communities and online accounts, so your subscriptions, memberships, social media. There's a place in there for your passwords, too. I think everybody should have a password manager, like LastPass or ProtonPass or something like that, where you can, you have all your passwords are stored encrypted, you have one master password, and you don't have to remember any of your passwords, and you're not reusing passwords, you have a unique password for every account, and once you get it set up, it's extremely easy. You just, anytime you go to log into anything, you just pull up that website, your bank or whatever, and it automatically populates your username and password and click login. That's it. It's so simple. I highly recommend it for anybody. And that makes it so easy for your next of kin. All they have to have is the master password and your phone, probably for like a two-factor authentication or something. Make sure, and then your password for your phone goes in a knock box. And your next of kin, all they would have to have is your phone and your master pass. They can get into any of your stuff. It makes it so much easier. Legal and tax. So, you know, your last year's tax returns, possibly. You might not have room in there for all of them because those things can get pretty big. But any legal matters, you know, any records from lawyers and things like that. And then you have a folder for estate documents. That would be your will, your trust, your power of attorney, your medical directives, guardianship if you have young children, and funeral arrangements. All that stuff would go there. And then they have a key bag where you put all your keys or copies of your keys. And they have little, nice little key labels. So you'd put a label on each key, and that way your next of kin knows this is the key for the garage, this is the key for the gate, this is the key for, you know, the car, this is the whatever, you know. And instead of, can you imagine the mess? You know what all your keys are. Does anybody else? Probably not. You imagine somebody else coming into your house after you're dead and they're like, where's the key to the house? Where's the key to the car? Where's the key to the shed? Where's the key? They don't know anything, right? They don't know where anything is. This takes care of all that stuff. So the Knockbox makes it easy to store and organize all your important documents in one place. So you can get one at the Knockbox. That's thenokbox.com. I actually tried to be an affiliate for them, but something got messed up. So that's not even an affiliate link. I'm not going to make any money off of this. So I just recommend doing it. They're not cheap. You're going to pay $100 and some bucks for one of them. I got a fireproof one myself, just in case, you know, place burns up and all that stuff. And it was only maybe $10 or $15 more than the regular one. So anyway, I definitely recommend it. If you love your family, it's definitely something to consider. If you hate your family, if you hate your wife, husband, or your children, then don't get a Knockbox. That would be a good way to really cause them months and months and months of grief and heartache. So anyway, I thank you for your kind and patient attention. And next time, we're going to pick it up and I'm going to talk about, what did I call it? Pastor Wagner's Practical Tips on Money Management. So it's going to be, basically, I'm going to start into a review of everything that we've talked about. I'm going to give you all the practical tips and things like that of everything money management. So I thank you for your kind and patient attention this morning.